Does a worldview have an effect on the way people act in their public and private life? Should a worldview affect how people act in their public and private life? And what the heck is a worldview anyway? Join us next for another Principles and Policies. Hello, this is Chuck Michaelis. I'm the Vice Chairman of the Institute for Principled Policy, and I'm also the Executive Director of Camp American. Well, you may think that's an odd question that I asked at the beginning, and you may not even understand what a worldview is. Well, a worldview is a way that you filter everything you take in, every bit of information, everything that you see, everything that you hear, everything that you read, and you filter it through that worldview, and then that is what your brain uses to analyze the data that it's taking in. And it also affects the things that you put out, everything you write, everything you say, everything you do is affected by your worldview. Does that make worldviews important? Well, I think that's pretty obvious, yes. So, what kind of worldviews are out there? Well, that's an interesting question. There are all kinds of different worldviews. Some of those worldviews are positive. Some of them are negative. And most people would say some of them are neutral, but there is no such thing as neutrality. So, they're either positive or negative. Well, at Camp American, and yes, we do talk a lot on this program about Camp American, but at Camp American, we've done our best to present some of the best worldview education and thinkers that we can find. Some of them speak more directly to the worldview issue, and some of them speak a little more subtly to the worldview issue. But the fact is, everybody we have at camp comes at it from a specific worldview. For instance, we frankly don't invite atheists to teach at Camp American. We are a Christian-based organization, and so we do not invite atheists to speak there. Why would we not invite atheists to speak there? Well, it's not because atheists don't have anything to say. It's because their worldview is corrupted and flawed. Now, everyone's worldview is a little bit corrupted and flawed, and that's why we get together and have discussions and hash things out about how to view things. And that's why it's productive to get together and discuss how issues are to be handled in our culture. We do it at work. We do it at home. We do it in our churches if our churches are healthy. We do it in all areas of life. And hopefully what we're doing is applying our biblically based values to every aspect of life. Does that include the way we run our families? Yes. Does that include the way we run our businesses? It's supposed to, yes. Does that include the way we interact with people in our workplace? Yes, it's supposed to. Does it affect the way we do politics? Yes, it's supposed to. Now, one of the reasons that we don't invite atheists to Camp American is because we understand that they understand this concept. It's interesting that in many cases, atheists and agnostics understand that principle, the fact that worldview affects everything, much better than Christians do. Because in many cases, especially in recent times, perhaps the last 15 years or so, Christians have taken on the attitude that really there is an area of neutrality, and even though we're Christians, we should not have any impact at all on, for instance, the political or the cultural realms, that those are really the domain of the world, and that since we're separate from the world, we're not supposed to have anything to do with those things. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's certainly not what the Bible teaches. And even though it is becoming a mainstay in many theological seminaries, and unfortunately, even very conservative theological seminaries, it is a grossly flawed idea. And basically, what we try to do with programs like this, and by the way, the reason that you're not getting a regular program where Barry and I kind of analyze and discuss issues is because Barry's unavailable, and I've been exceedingly busy this week, and we just ran out of time. And that happens from time to time, so we run a program like this. This is an audio from Camp America. Now, the reason we run this kind of thing is to kind of get you used to the idea that these worldview issues do affect everything that we do. And so, who are we going to present to you today? Well, we're presenting a worldview thinker who is a very interesting man. His name is Dr. Michael Kaufman. He is the CEO of a company called Environmental Perspectives Incorporated. He is an author of multiple books. And in fact, what he's giving a lecture on today is one of his books called Plundered. It's a great book. It's basically a review of progressive ideology and, in fact, progressive religion, if you will. And Dr. Kaufman is well-versed in a number of these issues. Now, he is an environmental scientist. He does extensive teaching on, and in fact, extensive government work. And when I say government work, he doesn't work for the government, but he does do things like prepare testimony and data to present to Congress on issues like global warming, the biodiversity treaty, any number of ways that the environmentalists, worldview environmentalists, and that's how Dr. Kaufman knows so much about this, he deals with worldview environmentalists, how these worldview environmentalists are using the things that they believe about the environment to attempt to affect things like global warming and ozone layer and biodiversity aspects of law. Dr. Kaufman has been very active in these areas, and Dr. Kaufman has been very successful in these areas. Now, he doesn't work by himself. He works with a network of other people, Tom DeWeese of the American Policy Center. And if you're familiar with any of our broadcasts in the past, we've had Tom DeWeese on here several times. We've interviewed Tom in earlier incarnations of our broadcast. And the reason that we're presenting Dr. Kaufman is because he kind of lays out in a very succinct and compact form the worldview issues that he is confronting and how progressive ideology, which is really kind of in many ways a form of a religion. So don't let anybody kid you that the progressive ideology isn't a religion. The fact that they reject God does not mean that they do not have a spiritual view. And in fact, some progressives do claim to profess Christianity and other religious beliefs. However, they profess a very different kind of Christianity. And one of the things that that you know if you've studied progressivism is that really progressivism is an outgrowth of 19th century liberal theology. That's a little deep for this particular session. However, Dr. Kaufman will explain that. Now, you're getting the first lecture here of, actually, there are four in this series. And I believe we have Dr. Kaufman's book, Plundered, available in our bookstore. I know we've given some away as prizes at our Institute on the Constitution classes, but in any case, they are available, I believe, in our bookstore, and if they're not, we will get them available for you. So, if you want to understand these issues, you need to listen to this broadcast today, and when we run subsequent broadcasts, we'll put links to all of them together so you won't lose any. So you can listen to them all in sequence if you'd like. It'll take a while to get them all up because I'm sure Barry and I will have a new program for you next week. In any case, here's Dr. Michael Kaufman with Plundered.
Well, good morning, everyone. This is late morning. You're ready for lunch, eager. After lunch, we'll continue our discussion. You'll be a lot more sleepy at that particular point in time. So will I, and you'll have to keep me awake, okay? But the reason that we're here right now and starting this is I want to give you a background of a major actual war that's going on within the United States right now. And it's described in the book, Plundered, that you are now getting a copy of. And it's extremely, extremely dangerous. It's every bit as dangerous as if the Soviet Union. How many remember what the Soviet Union is? Okay, not very many, which is shocking to me, but not too surprising, since most of you probably weren't even alive at the time that the Soviet Union fell. But the Soviet Union is now Russia. And Russia at that time was controlled by communism. And communism is what is trying to come into the United States today. And we would have fought a major world war to avoid that, and yet we're accepting it with open arms right now, the ideology. So that is an introduction. I have a PhD in ecosystems analysis and climatology. And I have been involved in the global warming efforts, as Chuck just said, as well as biodiversity for many, many years. I'll describe some of that later, probably tomorrow, as to what we did to stop the Biodiversity Treaty from being ratified. Because it was really a God thing. It wasn't really me, it was basically God. And it's really a fantastic story, even though it's getting a little bit old right now, but it does show you how God works. And what I am looking for in the next 2 days in describing is going through the war of worldviews right now, the global elite, and the IUCN and Agenda 21, I don't know why that's being cut off, smart growth and education will hit today as well, and the biodiversity and the wildlife project tomorrow, global warming tomorrow, as well as the importance of Christianity. It's extremely important that we understand the fact that Christianity is the backbone of the Constitution, as well as the ability to reinstate our freedoms and liberties. So, I'm not sure why this is happening. I'm going to have major problems with this if it continues. And it may be me, it may be this computer. Okay. Can you change it, do you think? Okay. Okay. So I'll have to fill in as we go along a little bit because some of the words will be cut off. But the key point here is to remember basically that we have two worldviews that are in competition today. One was established by John Locke back in the 1600s. Our Declaration of Independence, our Constitution, is based on the writings of Locke. Frederick Bastiat, which I love to talk about, but I'm not going to have time. Sir William Blackstone was an Englishman who was the first attorney to write a textbook and started Oxford University, the law school at Oxford. And William Jefferson, whom we just talked about, and James Madison, whom we just talked about, are all students of Locke. If you look at their particular approach to government, what you will find is that we have a government that is based on God's law and nature's God, as Barry talked about in the last section. I'm glad he did that. I don't have to spend a lot of time on it, but the fact is that our Constitution is really rooted in the Bible, which gives individuals the greatest power. Every individual in the United States is a sovereign. In other words, we have sovereign authority over our government, according to the Constitution of the United States. But we have allocated or given over portions of that sovereignty to our local government, usually city government, could be county government. But the fact is that they do not have the sovereign rights over us. We dictate to them what we think is important and not important. They are have the greatest authority over us because primarily the one elected body of government that is directly over and accounts for control over the population should be the one that is more accessible to the population, which is our local government. Then we have state government, which has less authority constitutionally, does not have authority over the local government in many ways, and then finally the federal government, and I got ahead here, which has, as we have just has just been described by Barry, of having only 18 enumerated powers. Only 18. That's it. Of course, now we have thousands And those thousands are eliminating our liberties. Now, you've heard many times the newspapers and the speaking heads on TV and so forth that our Constitution is a living document, that it was written for a people of 230 years ago, not for today's society. Now, Barry said that's hogwash, and it is. What we're seeing today is basically the fact that our Congress is taking over slowly. It's not, but the whole purpose of the Constitution, as Barry said, was to limit the powers of the government, to spell them out. The Constitution is designed to restrict the government, not you and I. Yes.
Well, I think just quickly here, so I don't bring up speed there. The difference between powers and rights.
Yes.
In that people have rights, governments have powers. In that people, rights are God-given, powers are delegated by the people.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. So the government or the Constitution is designed to really prevent government from assuming too much power over our rights. It's not to restrict citizen activity by itself. I mean, there are laws that are passed and so forth for the benefit of the population that control, like murder, greed, and other sundry things that are necessary. But those are the delegated powers that we have given, the people have given to the government. They're not assumed by the government. And Jefferson said this, it is not by the consolidation or the concentration of powers, but by their distribution that good government is effected. Now, what did he mean by that? If one of you had all power, do you think that would be abusive? Even the best person in the world would eventually abuse that power because they have it. And they will, that's human nature. Human nature is very, very selfish and will be exerted where they have the ability to do it. Any one of us would become a tyrant or likely to become a tyrant if given the opportunity. Therefore, our government should be, the power of our government should be distributed so that no one group of people within the government, the legislative, executive, or judicial branches, will have all power. The federal government, the powers are separate. The state, the powers are separate. And local, generally, the powers are separate. They're called the tripartite system, divided into three groups of power holders. And these are basically how we are have a limited government so that we do not exceed our ability to control the government because we have now an out-of-control government. Okay, if you go to Section 8, what Barry talked about the fact that we have 18 enumerated powers. I just want to focus on two because I'll be coming back to them. The only powers that the federal government has to own land is to establish post offices and post roads, our interstate system, for instance, our federal highway system, or the equivalent of post roads. Secondly, in Articles 18, I think, or 16, is to exercise exclusive legislation in all cases wherever such a district exceeds 10 miles, that's the Washington, D.C. And let's see, I really want to go down to here. I can't read it because it's off the screen. This is going to be a problem. Work on it over the next hour. But basically what it says is that the government should only have the power to build forts, arsenals, and naval yards. Period. That's all. And yet now the federal government owns over one-third of the entire United States. So how did that happen? They basically violated the premise of the Constitution. They basically, the western states of the United States, they basically put a gun to the heads of the territories as they were claiming statehood and said that you have no right to take the federal lands as state lands. If you want to become a state, that's the condition that you have to do. And violated the equal footing doctrine that was established at the time of the writing of the Constitution and established the fact that the federal government is now a landlord over the lives of most Western citizens. Now, we also looked at least the 10th Amendment, but then I think the 9th Amendment is also important. The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage other retained rights to the people. In other words, and then you go to the 10th Amendment that Barry's already talked about, and the fact is that the states and the people assume most rights. The federal government only has 18 enumerated powers, period. At least in principle, according to the Constitution and the rule of law. Now, John Locke said this, "The purpose of the government is to join together to unite for the mutual preservation of their lives, liberties, and estate." Does that sound familiar? Where have you heard that wording before? Luke. Declaration of Independence. If there was ever any doubt that our Declaration of Independence and our Constitution was based upon the writings of John Locke, this should put an end to it. I mean, it was almost a verbatim use of what John Locke had penned a couple hundred years earlier, or 100 years earlier, which basically is called by the general name property. In fact, the first few drafts that Jefferson did of the Declaration of Independence, it was property that he put in there, life, liberty, and property. However, even then, the average citizen looked at property as merely their piece of land or their home. And since property extends to all avenues, including our personal selves, they actually changed the Declaration of Independence, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Because you need to protect your private property rights in order to pursue your happiness. You can't do it without it. I'll explain why in a moment. Therefore, as the great and chief end of uniting into commonwealths or to governments and nations is and putting themselves under the government is the preservation of their property. In other words, Locke understood the importance of private property rights. The whole purpose of government is to protect private property rights. That's the entire purpose. Because without private property rights, you have no liberty, period. James Madison reaffirmed this, and so did several other of the founders. The government is instituted to protect property of every sort. Your money is property. A contract that you sign is property. And we've been violating that all over the place, especially the last 3.5 years, but it's happened long before that, as well as that which lies in the various rights of individuals, this being the end of government, that alone is a just government which impartially secures to every man whatever is his own. And we're very rapidly losing our private property rights. Every law that we now, and I'll talk about it later on, probably this afternoon, is being created is designed to remove our private property rights. I can't overemphasize the importance of private property rights. Most people think it's not important. Most people look at private property rights as an evil of some sort. It's not. It is the basis of wealth creation. For instance, the average 2010 income for Americans was $47,200. It's gone up to about $48,500 now. Socialist Europeans was $32,700. Why the difference? If you really look at it, it boils down to private property rights. Most of Europe is now very socialistic. They have a regulation to define what every citizen in Europe can do or not do. And when you have that type of regulatory power, you basically restrain the individual from doing what might be best, not only for himself or herself, but also for the nation. Because you have a bureaucrat basically saying that you can't do that. Why? Because the bureaucrat has control over what you can and cannot do. And a lot of it comes down to the subjective judgment. But that's not nearly as bad as the former communist nations. Back in 1992, during the fall of the Soviet Union, the average communist country, the individuals earned less than $1,000 a year. Why? Because they had no private property rights. The state controlled everything that they did. There was no such thing as private property, period. That has changed to some extent in both Russia and China now. They have a modified version of property rights. And today is about $10,000 to $20,000 a year because they have released the effect of private property so that it really is starting to generate some income, not only for the individuals who use it, but also for the nation itself. Third world nations, basically because of a variety of other forms of government, including socialism, are less than $10,000 a year. If you actually plot this against an index of legally protected property rights, then what you will find is that there is a fairly strong correlation, 74%, between an index of property rights. Now, you can argue over the property, what's used in the property rights to determine that index, but most of them have to at least consider most of the same things, and they all turn out like this, that there is a strong correlation. Now, there are other graphs that are done using other bases for the index. None of them turn out to be nearly as important as private property rights. And obviously, those things do affect, and why we have as much variability in this graph is that there are other things to consider, but the root, the foundation for wealth creation is private property rights. John Locke knew that.
Well, and also the difference between a free man and a slave is the right to own property.
Absolutely.
Because a slave is actually the property of someone else, himself.
Yes.
And the other person who owns him can tell him whatever he wants him to do.
Right.
Whereas a free man is an independent agent. He can own
him. Right. It's one of the reasons that the British Empire became the largest empire of the world in world's history. It's because the Magna Carta in 1230, I think, 1215, started the process. By itself, it's not that important, but it went through several revisions. By the time that John Locke was writing his various treaties in the 1600s, it had evolved to the point where the average citizen could own property. Up until that time, the average citizen could not own property. It was just the royalty. When the average citizen can own property, as was just mentioned, all of a sudden they're free to begin to do things that they see are needed by the population that they can provide a service or a good to meet. And they can invest in many of the ships going down to the Orient and so forth, to bring back a lot of merchandise that are important. Up until then, they could not do that. So it was really a key step in England. The Magna Carta, as it evolved, allowed a middle class to develop.
Another thing, Mike, a lot of the Islamic countries that we're seeing so much trouble with today are tribal societies.
Yes.
Where property is owned by the tribe. And the people themselves in the Islamic countries are under dictatorship.
Not only under dictatorship, but they're just merely cogs in the wheel for whatever the chieftain of that tribe wants to do. They're not considered worthy or important at all as a individual.
And that's why they do suicide bombing.
That's why they can do suicide bombing, right. So, really, we have lost that vision of why property rights are very important. A Peruvian, no less, back in the 2000, began to realize the importance of private property rights. And he did a massive worldwide study in which he looked at why capitalism has failed in the former communist blocs while succeeding in the West. And what he found basically was that it's related to property. He found that 70% of all small business in the United States are started with equity loans on personal homes. In developing nations, it takes 10 to 20 years to register property ownership and hundreds of bureaucratic steps, all wanting their kickbacks because corruption is the name of the game. It's part of their society. Now, if you just bought a $2,000 piece of property, because property is very much undervalued because you can't use it for anything, and you have to spend $5,000 in payoffs and so forth to get it registered, are you going to register it? No, so it's never registered. It never has legally protected. It's never legally protected. And as a consequence, that kills their ability to create wealth with their private property. Property rights are not legally established, and as a consequence, Hernando de Soto calls it dead capital. It's there. That land or house or whatever is worth something, but they can never access it with a loan, a secondary mortgage loan or something of that nature. And as a consequence, they can't borrow against what they own to be able to start a business or to buy into another business. And so, wealth is not created. And this is one of the big damning things about socialism, is because of the constraints imposed by the bureaucracy, that ability to create wealth is seriously diminished. And it's happening here in this country too. Now this was in the year 2000, it's a lot more now. But DeSoto estimates there is a $9.3 trillion worth of dead capital worldwide. And I just want to show you the impact of what that $9.3 trillion really is. This is capital that cannot be used by the owners of property, homes, and so forth in these third world nations. That $9.3 trillion in 2000 was equal to all the capital in the 10 major stock exchanges in the world. So the New York Stock Exchange, all of these stock exchanges we have, and China has, and Japan has, and Europe has, and so forth, doesn't equal $9.3 trillion, at least not in 2000, or basically equals that. Now, what does that mean? If you look at it even more, it's 93 times more than all the foreign aid ever given, and 46 times all the loans ever given by the World Bank. Now, what would happen if the citizens of those nations were giving access to that $9.3 trillion worth of capital? Do you think they would need foreign aid? No. Do you think we would have to give out foreign aid? No. So why aren't we doing it? You know, when the Soviet Union fell back in 1992, we rushed in and gave them all the tools of capitalism except the legal protection of private property rights. And it failed miserably to the point now where the average Russian hates the idea of capitalism. And that was intended. Why? Because if they have to give out foreign aid or to survive, or they have to receive foreign aid to survive, we control them. Very simple. It's evil. And they're trying to do the same thing to the American population. The other form, or the other worldview or ideology, was that one developed by Jean-Jacques Rousseau in the 1700s, immediately following on the two treaties written by John Locke. Now, Rousseau had read Locke, but he disagreed with him, and he disagreed with him violently. Now, if you read in your history books, how many of you are in public education? Anybody here? I'm not saying that public education you can't be, but hopefully your parents talk to you a lot. But the fact is that we have a situation right now, basically, that we are now have the Rousseau philosophy in our education system, in our legal system, in our judicial system, basically in our media and all the others, that is diametrically opposed to the Locke model. Diametrically opposed. And it's important. Most people are liberals today because they don't know any better. They have been trained to be liberals in our educational process. They're very intelligent. They will make the right decisions if given the right information, but they're never given the right information. I'll talk about that this afternoon, probably. But Jean-Jacques Rousseau is known as the father of the French Revolution. I'll get to that in a minute. And modern European socialism and communism. His adherents are George W.F. Hegel. If you ever understand what our education system and why it's so corrupted, it's because it's based on Hegel's writings. Karl Marx, Marxism that led into communism. Friedrich Engels, same thing. And that is what's taking over our culture today, is a system that will destroy our liberties and our freedoms. Understand that. If you take nothing away from this, understand that we are at war for our very liberties. Now, Jean-Jacques Rousseau said this in his Social Contract. It's one of his writings, named The Social Contract. Do you have a volume hookup? If you don't, I'll use a microphone. Property rights were designed by the rich to put new fetters on the poor and gave new powers to the rich. He had exactly this opposite viewpoint that Locke had. Why? Because France was still under the feudal system. How many understand what the feudal system was all about? Okay, you should have learned it in elementary school. You really should have. If I say what it is, you'll probably remember. It is the basis of the fact that you have a very few of the nobility that own all the land. And the rest of the population are serfs, or peasants, which then are contracted, which have to contract with the nobility to provide a certain portion of their crops and so forth to the nobility or the earnings thereof. So it was a basic system where the elite controlled everything because they owned the property. And if a family wanted to survive, they had to put themselves under one of the nobles in order to survive, because the only way you can survive is to own property or do something with property. And the nobility owned everything. And so that's why, or one of the reasons why, Rousseau saw property as an evil, because only the nobility and the Catholic Church at the time could own land. The church itself was very abusive during that particular period of time. Most of your priests and so forth were not. But nonetheless, the upper echelons of the Catholic Church did a lot of bad things during those times, which irretrievably destroyed natural liberty, he thought, because it suppressed the average peasant. And for the advantage of a few ambitious individuals, subjected all mankind to perpetual labor, slavery, and wretchedness, which in France was true. Now, there was a number of other things going on, and I'm not going to get into them, but it basically goes back to that. Now, he also said that whoever refuses to obey the general will, that's what he had within the social contract, a general will. This is the will of the entire population. Now, the entire population obviously did not have an opportunity to contribute to that general will. It was done by the elite within the government, not the nobility in this case, but by the government. And so we still had a system that was almost identical to that of feudalism, as we shall see. The general will designed by the government shall be constrained to do so by the entire body. In other words, anybody who gets out of line pays a price. In this lies the key to the political machine. This alone legitimizes civil undertaking. So two things, the general will and basically the constraint by the government on people's rights. In other words, the government defined what the rights would be. The state, in relation to its members, is master of all goods through the social contract, which within the state is the basis of all rights. Now, you have heard our president talking about positive rights, where the government defines what the citizens or the government has to do for the citizens, but it also defines what the citizens can and cannot do. This is called positive rights. And it was originally taken from the writings of Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Rousseau also said, "Each of us puts his person and all his possessions in common under the supreme direction of the general will, that which is defined by the government. And in our corporate capacity, we receive each member as an individual part of the whole." That is classic communism. It even goes beyond socialism. In other words, no one has property. You all give it to the common good and work for the common good, and we receive each part in back. Yes?
And just if in college, if you take psychology or social science courses, they kind of they call this collectivism.
Right. Good point. Very good point. Collectivism is another outcome or another word describing exactly this. Versus individualism that our Constitution is based upon. Okay, this is really starting to get dangerous now. He also said in the social contract that the humble Christians changed their language, and soon this so-called kingdom of the other world turned under a visible leader, Jesus, into the most violent earth of earthly despotisms. Now, he was looking at the Catholic Church, which was not doing very good at the point, that particular point in history. But I will say this right now. Once the church is institutionalized, generally it will gravitate towards despotism, just as any other human institution will do. The church, being founded in lies and errors, deceives men, makes them credulous and superstitious, becomes tyrannous and exclusive, and makes a people bloodthirsty and intolerant, so that they breathe fire and slaughter, killing everyone who does not believe in its God. And of course, you see the Catholic Church a couple centuries before this. What was it called when the Catholic Church put people on?
Inquisition.
He was referring back to the Inquisition. Now, the Inquisition wasn't happening at that time, but he had the fodder necessary to do it, to say these things. But this is really, he turns around and does the same thing again. And it, almost every human effort will do this. They will tear apart the opposition that they hate. And once they get the power, they will do exactly the same thing. Except they're not now in a position of power. And this is what Rousseau said. The government can banish from the state whoever does not believe them, the religious articles of faith. He hated Christianity, so he substituted in place of Christianity a civil religion with certain precepts and so forth. He allowed Christianity to go on, sort of, but very weakened and very benign in the sense of what its power was within the nation. They are antisocial and capable. These people who do not believe in the civil religion are antisocial and capable of loving and the laws of justice and a sacrifice that need his life to his duty. In other words, a Christian understands that he is sovereign, biblically understanding. That is not true with civil religion that Rousseau was establishing. He was basically establishing a church, as it were, that was a collective that was obedient to a central authority in every way. This is what he goes on, and this is really horrifying. If he does not believe them or the civil religion and tenets of faith, then let him be punished by death. He has committed the worst of all crimes. In other words, he was doing or recommending it be done the same thing the Catholic Church had done with the Inquisition.
And you will find this in almost every case where a person who comes into power and bases his philosophy on his own thoughts will eventually replace the previous entity of authority with exactly the same crimes that they committed and that he accused them of doing, or she. Ironically, if you look, and this is a very conservative number, well over 125 million people who have accepted Rousseau's writings as the basis of their government. Communism, Nazism, the fascist system, communism in Cambodia, North Korea, Koreans, all these things add up to well over 124. Some people will put it almost 200 million people because they did not agree with the government. It goes right back to this Seditious Act that we were talking about with Barry. Same principle. If you don't agree with the government, you can be killed and murdered. And millions and millions and millions of people have had that experience. It does not have a pleasant history. None of what we have seen over history supports the Rousseau model of government. And yet we're very close, probably one election away from having that imposed in the United States. Now, if you have a question, this was done last year in April because President Clinton or President Obama was actually talking about what Rousseau had written. So let's just take a look or listen to what Bill Riley says about that, what Obama was doing. He noticed he didn't do it very long because he realized he was exposing his hands. Oops.
Listen carefully.
Yes. Is this hot?
It won't do any good.
Okay. Why?
We don't have a PA system. We don't have a public address.
This doesn't go to the...
It goes to the...
That's what I'm doing. Okay. I want to at least get it on tape. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Bill O'Reilly. Thanks for watching us tonight. President Obama and the Social Compact. That is the subject of this evening's Talking Points memo. This week, the president will hold three town meetings around the country trying to sell his vision of a strong America based on responsible spending and, quote, the social compact. What's that? First, the president talking about Republicans wanting to cut the budget.
This vision is less about reducing the deficit than it is about changing the basic social compact in America. And I don't think there's anything courageous about asking for sacrifice from those who can least afford it and don't have any clout on Capitol Hill. That's not a vision of the America I know.
So again, what is the president talking about? The social compact, also called the social contract, was made popular by French philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau in the 18th century. Basically, Rousseau says that a central government has an obligation to help its citizens in pretty much every way. The dictionary definition of the term social compact is this, quote, an agreement entered into by individuals that results in the formation of the state or of organized society, the prime motive being the desire for protection, which entails the surrender of some or all personal liberties. Very interesting. The desire for protection is not only against Al-Qaeda or Attila the Hun, but also against starving or being homeless. America largely avoided the social compact until the Great Depression in 1929. So many people were suffering that President Roosevelt began the Entitlement Society, that is direct federal help for those who were in trouble economically. In 1935, the Social Security Act was passed, providing money for the elderly. Since that time, the federal government has grown enormously, and now America faces economic ruin because it owes more than $14 trillion. Just today, the country's debt level was highlighted worldwide, resulting in a very bad day for the stock market. But still, many Americans, including Mr. Obama, do not want to cut entitlement programs very much. This is the war that is raging throughout America. It is between conservatives who emphasize personal responsibility and achievement against liberals who say the government must take from the wealthy and give to the poor. So it'll be interesting this week to see if President Obama can rally the country to support his vision of a strong social compact. He has compassion on his side. Few Americans want to see their fellow citizens suffer. But the president does have that fiscal responsibility issue haunting him because the country remains in dire trouble. And that's a memo now.
So what do we see here? First of all, he says that this vision that we're seeing today that the Republicans are trying to do is not his vision, not his social compact. Compact. What does he mean by that? It's not the vision that he knows. He's implying that this is what the country was based upon, was Rousseau's writings. In other words, he was bringing in a false statement to make it the truth for the country. He was trouncing on the constitutional principles of sovereignty for the individual, while saying that this is the way it always has been. Well, let me tell you, if there's anybody here that's my age, we know differently. We have radically changed over the last 40 years. This is nothing like the nation that I once knew as a younger adult and child. Nothing. We are so restricted and constrained right now that we are, and I'll be getting into this after lunch, that our country is technically bankrupt. In just 3.5 years, by the time that president will end his term, this first term, he will have accumulated more debt than all the presidents up until George W. Bush. Because he is pushing his entitlement progressive programs. And we folks are hollowed out. We basically do not have any ability to withstand another economic strain, and it's coming. So with that in mind, I think it's about time for lunch. Is that right?
Oh, you've got a few minutes left.
Okay, let's go on then. So what we're seeing here is the Rousseau model puts the federal government with all power. It's a centralized form of government that basically dictates to the states. The states are merely an administrative unit. They have no sovereignty of their own. The local government has no sovereignty of its own, and neither do we. We are totally under the thumb of the federal government if we keep on going in the direction that we're going right now. The media, the mainstream media, that is controlled by this ideology. Yes?
I'm going to give you a sidebar. I don't want to butt in.
But you will.
This is the system that, believe it or not, James Madison and Alexander Hamilton wanted to impose.
Yes. Even though James Madison didn't really want to see this, but he allowed the conditions necessary for it to develop.
Right. He didn't understand necessarily. James Madison is given too much credit for his intellectual capability. Whatever philosophy, whatever person he was close to at that time. And he became close to Jefferson, and that's why he became a Republican. At that point, he had been close to Hamilton. And he and Hamilton split over the national bank issue.
Yes.
In Washington, happened. So you'll get more of that when I talk about it.
Yeah. You pay attention as we go along. You'll find that all the talks are interrelated. I'm building off of what you already heard here today, earlier. And really, it's an exciting thing to see. You have an opportunity in this coming next 5 days to learn more than the average citizen ever learns in their lifetime. Now, progressive ideology, because that's what we're facing with the Rousseau model of government, is the Republicans and the Democrats are both progressive. Progressivism basically controls both political parties. This is not politics as usual. This is wholly different. And they will do everything they can to keep you ignorant of the fact that the basic argument isn't Republican or Democrat. It is basically whether or not we want the constitutional model of government or the Rousseau model of government. They don't want you to understand that that's what the arguments are really truly about. They don't want you to understand that the Tea Party movement basically is based on the constitutional premises established by our founding fathers and the Locke model of government. Because if you knew that, you might be persuaded not to support what is happening in Congress and so forth, and actually vote these people out of office in November. I know you can't vote, but your parents can. The Republican progressives tend towards fascism. They want the private property to still exist, but the property owner can't do anything without government permission. They want industry to be private because industry basically is far more effective than basically the state-run organizations. So they use the capital from the state, from the industry, to institute government programs. That's exactly what we're facing right now today. The Democrats, on the other hand, the far left, the socialism, I'm not sure what I meant there, but nonetheless, it was a big Marxism, yes, thank you. Then we have the centralized government in both cases. Why don't we ever see a change when we elect presidents that are Republican or congresses that are Republican? Because they're controlled by the neocons and they want to centralize government, both of them. That's why we never see any change. They want to be, the Republicans want to be the world's policemen. They basically go to war without congressional approval. While the Democrats, far left, massive social programs trying to fix everything. Because they believe that the average person, and this is the biggest fault that they have, the average person basically is the way they are because of bad government. Given the right government and the right opportunity, everyone will do the right thing. Now, Barry, when he talked earlier, talked about human nature. We understand from the Bible that everyone has human nature, and that fundamental human nature is evil. It's very selfish. But the progressive left honestly believes that every person is good. And so if they give them the money necessary to do the right thing, they will do the right thing. And they, of course, human nature will dictate they will never do the right thing, or rarely. Well, that's true. Yeah. Right. Way back to Horace Mann, back in the 17th century. Right. I'm not going to get into that too much, but you'll see more of that premise this afternoon. Republicans more focused, the progressives more focused on public-private partnerships. They desire huge amounts of regulations because they want central control. That's why we don't see any changes when we shift administrations and so forth. I'll tell you why we don't see any changes this afternoon. The Democratic far left, if they could, they want government ownership over everything, or control over everything. They don't want to have any private property whatsoever. That's really getting into communism, which does not allow, pure Marxism, which does not allow private property. They have to settle for more of what the Republican neocons want, and that is severe regulations. And then we have controlled capitalism for the Republicans, heavy taxation and so forth for the Democrats, and again, there's a lot of interchange. The people that are neocons within the Republican Party are Nixon, both Bushes, Lindsey Graham from South Carolina, Olympia Snowe from Maine, which is retiring, thank God. I just hope we don't get Angus King back in to replace her. Romney basically has exhibited everything about a neocon, and he has gotten tremendous financing and political power from these people that are controlling us in order to be the Republican candidate. I'll show you how that's done this afternoon. Obama is proud of it. Pelosi is proud of it. Reid is proud of it. Congressman Waters is basically, she's admitted to being communist. Schumer from New York is also, you can go on and on and on. The same with the Republican side, that most of Congress is now controlled by progressives. either Republican or Democrat. So understand that. Are we about ready to? Okay.
That's it for this week. We hope you enjoyed it. Join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.